The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the February 16th, 2024 issue of the Week. Before we get started, I do need to tell you that I'm coming off of a pretty rough cold and sore throat, thus the voice, and please bear with me today. We'll see how it goes. The cover drawing this week has the popular couple of Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. They're standing in the middle of a football field, crowded stadium, Kelce in his football uniform, Swift in a performing outfit. And their eyes, instead of their regular eyes, they have what look like laser beams coming out of them. Kelce's holding up a needle and has a button that says, "I got the vaccine." And Swift is wearing a Biden-Harris 2024 button. The headline is "Conspiracy Theory: Why Team MAGA Thinks Swift and Kelce Are Playing for the Deep State." We picked that up on our Controversy of the Week, but I'm going to start today actually with the editor's letter. In the early days of the week, we splayed out a smorgasbord of daily newspapers on a long rectangular table in the center of the room. In addition to the New York Times, the Washington Post, in the Wall Street Journal, the staff sifted through the Miami Herald, Boston Globe, Philadelphia Inquirer, Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and several news magazines in our quest for tasty articles to curate for our readers. For a news junkie, the array of fine reporting, writing, and news presentation on that table was thrilling, tangible proof of the vital role journalism plays in our democracy. That was two decades ago, before Google, Facebook, and the Internet laid waste to print newspapers and magazines. Now many of the websites that replace them are also struggling and dying. As Elon Musk gloated last week, the implosion of legacy media is a boon for unfiltered, user-generated sources of information like his X, which enables the people to define the narrative. Ah, yes, the narrative. How liberating to be freed from the fusty standards of evidence imposed by journalists, scientists, historians, and other obsolete sources of authority. The mainstream media, for example, would never have told you that Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce, the NFL, and the deep state are conspiring to deny Donald Trump a second term. That narrative may be easy to laugh off, but in the disinformation age, millions of citizens have adopted equally nonsensical beliefs about vaccines, election fraud, January 6th climate change, gun violence Ukraine, and the Great Replacement conspiracy, with much graver implications. Expertise, evidence, and nuanced perspective are out. Now you can get alternative facts and tribal dogma from simple-minded podcasters and TikTok influencers, rageaholic cable TV hosts, and reactionary billionaires. Dead and dying newspapers aren't coming back, but we need to think more carefully and critically about what's replacing them. That was Bill Falk, editor-at-large. And we'll move into the main stories, starting with Republicans sink bipartisan border deal. What happened? A border security bill negotiated for months by a bipartisan group of senators died a quick death on its release this week after it was savaged by the same conservative Republicans who demanded such a bill as a condition for passing Ukraine aid. The bill would have provided an extra $20 billion for border security, made it harder for migrants to claim asylum, and automatically closed the border when illegal crossings reached an average of 5,000 a day. It also included $60 billion in funding for Ukraine and $14 billion for Israel. But spurred on by GOP frontrunner Donald Trump, who views the migrant surge at the southern border as an electoral liability for President Biden, Republicans assailed the bill as insufficient. House Speaker Mike Johnson said the legislation was dead on arrival in his chamber. Senator John Barrasso, the Senate's number three GOP leader, said Americans will turn to the upcoming election to end the border crisis. The bill ultimately secured the backing of only four GOP senators and fell far short of the 60 votes needed to advance. President Biden vowed to campaign on the issue, saying MAGA Republicans opposed increased border security because they're afraid of Donald Trump. Meanwhile, an effort by House Republicans to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas for willful and systemic refusal to enforce border laws failed after three Republicans joined Democrats in opposition. As the week went to press, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer was pushing ahead with Plan B, a foreign aid bill for Israel and Ukraine stripped of the border deal. What the editorial said. Republicans had a choice, said the Wall Street Journal, to pass the most restrictive migrant legislation in decades or keep an open sore festering for another year to aid Trump's reelection effort. The bill, endorsed by the Border Patrol Union, included longtime GOP priorities such as restrictions to the catch-and-release policy that lets migrants claiming asylum spend years in the U.S. awaiting a court date. But Republicans under Trump's sway chose to reject this policy victory, ensuring the border chaos will continue and handing Democrats a potent political weapon. We really do have a border problem on our hands, said the Houston Chronicle. More than 11,000 migrants cross the border every day in December, and our asylum system is overwhelmed. But the chaos in Washington now rivals anything at the border. Just days ago, Senate Republicans were touting this bill as the toughest immigration reform plan seen in years. But afraid of angering Trump, they killed it. The GOP's heedless cynicism is breathtaking. What the columnist said. The failed impeachment of Mayorkas was a spectacular embarrassment for Johnson, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com, and a marker of a House in utter disarray. The debacle further undermined an already dubious case for impeachment, which was more focused on policy disagreements than high crimes and misdemeanors. And that loss was followed quickly by another humiliation for Johnson, when his bid to pass a standalone bill with billions in Israel aid failed, as the House devolves into an engine for Donald Trump's political stunts. This divided, angry Congress capacity to govern at the most basic level appears to be imploding. History will record this as the week the GOP formally kowtowed to Vladimir Putin, said Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Republicans not only sacrificed border security, but also threw in the towel on desperately needed Ukraine aid. It's especially appalling, given that many of them understand what's at stake at a critical moment for Ukraine, which is running low on ammunition and facing national dismemberment at Russia's hands. In abandoning our ally, Congress is sending a message of profound weakness, sure to be noted in Beijing, Tehran, and Pyongyang. We've all grown inured to political absurdity, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch, but consider the special absurdity of this moment. Last fall, Republicans blocked Ukraine aid and demanded border action first. Now, after letting undersupplied Ukrainian troops languish in the field for months, they're rejecting the resulting effort to target a problem they insist is an urgent national crisis and sending us back to square one. This is what it now means to be a loyal Republican. Better that government ceases to function than that Trump fails to get what he wants. And a second shorter main story. Appeals court rejects Trump's immunity claim. What happened? A federal appeals court this week unanimously rejected Donald Trump's sweeping claim of immunity from prosecution for his attempts to overturn his 2020 election defeat, boosting the chances that he will stand trial before November's election, giving a president unbounded authority to commit crimes that would neutralize the most fundamental check on executive power. A three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled would undermine our whole electoral process and collapse our system of separate powers. The judges, including a George H.W. Bush nominee who'd sided with Trump in prior cases, found Trump's appeal antithetical to the Constitution, writing that it would be a striking paradox if the office holder tasked with overseeing the faithful execution of federal law were also above the law. The judges gave Trump 6 days to take his appeal to the Supreme Court, which he vowed to do, fuming on social media that without blanket criminal immunity, a president will be afraid to act for fear of the opposite party's vicious retribution after leaving office. The Supreme Court was set this week to hear a separate Trump appeal over Colorado's effort to disqualify him from its ballot for inciting the January 6th insurrection. With Trump's Washington, D.C. case on hold because of his immunity appeal, the first of his four criminal trials is likely to be in New York, where he's set to stand trial March 25th over hush money payments to a mistress ahead of the 2016 election. What the columnist said: Trump's frivolous bid for immunity is just a delaying tactic, said Ray Brescia in the Daily Beast. The judge's emphatic ruling came an agonizing 28 days after oral arguments, when Trump's lawyers made the laughable case that even if a president ordered SEAL Team 6 to kill an opponent, he'd be immune from prosecution if he was not impeached and convicted by Congress. The Supreme Court should do what it does with thousands of cases each year, refuse to intervene and let the trial court get back to work. This is a case in which the Supreme Court may want the last word, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Claiming presidents have total criminal immunity is obviously wrong, but the D.C. Circuit went overboard by declaring that a president has no immunity at all. Presidents often do things that are later seen as violating statutes, such as President Truman's seizure of steel mills. By the court's logic, any such actions could expose presidents to prosecution after leaving office. Timing is everything, said Timothy L. O'Brien in Bloomberg. Biden and Trump are statistically tied in polls. But if Trump is criminally convicted, 51% of poll respondents said they'd back Biden, while 45% would stick with Trump. Even if a verdict isn't reached by then, a trial could damage Trump. One thing's for sure, if he's elected before a conviction, he will quash the prosecutions or seek to pardon himself. And our controversy of the week, MAGA. Why is Trump world afraid of Taylor Swift? Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce may be America's sweetheart, said David Korn and Mother Jones, but they're also threats to the national security of MAGA land. For those blissfully unaware of the far right's current fever dream, Fox News host and Trumpist influencers have been promoting for weeks the truly bonkers conspiracy theory that the very public romance between the pop superstar and Kansas City Chiefs tight end is a Pentagon psyop, a sprawling cabal of deep state globalists encompassing the White House, George Soros, and the National Football League, supposedly engineered the Chiefs' Super Bowl run to lend more oomph to the power couple's presumed 2024 endorsement of President Biden. This is not the first lunatic idea to have gotten traction on the right, said Rich Lowry in Politico, but it might be the most stupid and perverse. What could better embody the traditional American values conservatives say they support than a burly football star hooking up with a girly former country singer? And then there's the electoral insanity of attacking Swift, the most popular musician on the planet, who needs the NFL to promote her, much as John Lennon needed Yoko Ono to make him popular. Dumb and strange is par for the course with MAGA, said David French in the New York Times. Since Donald Trump launched his political career on the birther theory that President Barack Obama was born in Kenya, his MAGA movement has lurched from one deeply weird conspiracy theory to the next. That Kelsey is a pitchman for Pfizer's COVID vaccine and Swift endorsed Joe Biden in 2020 gives the couple an infernal combination of affiliations, making them a natural target of MAGA paranoia. Conservatives do resent Swift's politics and her potential to drive legions of Swifties to the polls, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. But mostly the right is mad at this happily unmarried 34-year-old billionaire for shattering the myth that women end up ugly and unloved if they put their career before family. What really has MAGA heads exploding, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, is the intrusion of Swift's juggernaut into football. The angry young men who are Trump's loudest supporters consider football their sport. Macho, regimented, nationalistic, violent. A last redoubt of real America in a culture otherwise lost to gender-fluid horrors of liberalism. To these MAGA bros, even a 10-second cutaway shot of Swift cheering Kelsey on from a stadium box feels like an unbearable invasion of their safe space. Not to mention a betrayal, said Jeet here in The Nation. The tall, blonde, country-singing Swift was once an idolized Aryan goddess to the racist far right. Then she pivoted to pop, endorsed Biden, and hell hath no fury like a Nazi spurned. We on the right need to get a grip, said Adam Carrington in the Washington Examiner. Since the days of Dr. Strangelove, the left has mocked conservatives as paranoid lunatics in tinfoil hats, with so much real-life depravity and corruption on the left to expose this election year, why are we validating that old caricature and alienating moderates with this nutty conspiracy theory? Because some Republicans overlearned the lesson of Trump's 2016 victory, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Having watched the destabilizing Trump succeed where safe and moderate nominees like John McCain and Mitt Romney failed, they decided to embrace abnormality at every turn. This extends, it seems, to reviling a couple so likable, attractive, and downright wholesome in presentation that in simpler times there might have been whispers they were part of a right-wing plot to promote conservative Americana. And we've got our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for steam power after the occupants of a Tesla that accidentally drove off an Oslo pier into a frozen fjord were rescued by the towel-wrapped passengers of a floating sauna. The two shivering motorists were able to warm up in the sauna, said the boat skipper. It was a good week for moving the needle after Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel was announced as a backer of the Enhanced Games, an upstart rival to the Olympics in which athletes will be encouraged to use performance-enhancing drugs out in the open and honestly. It was a good week for useful idiots after former Fox News host Tucker Carlson traveled to Moscow to interview Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin said it had denied many interview requests from Anglo-Saxon media, but gave Carlson the nod because his position is different. But it was a bad week for draining the swamp after Donald Trump, who holds up to $5 million in Anheuser-Busch stock, asked conservatives to give the Bud Light maker a second chance and abandon their boycott of the firm over its brief sponsorship deal with a transgender influencer. It's a bad week for empty nesters, some of whom are so despondent about their children leaving for college that they are now employing $250-an-hour counselors to help them adapt to life alone. These parents need to grieve, said Los Angeles-based empty nest coach Natalie Kane. Finally, it was a bad week for counter-espionage after a pigeon held for 8 months on suspicion of being a Chinese spy was set free by Indian authorities. Officials determined that the bird, which had a pair of ankle rings bearing Chinese writing, was a lost Taiwanese racing pigeon. The briefing in this issue is titled "The Troubled Teen Industry." Every year, thousands of children are placed in behavioral treatment centers and camps where allegations of abuse are rife. What is the troubled teen industry? It's a loose network of reform schools, treatment centers, religious academies, and wilderness therapy camps across the U.S. that purport to treat young people struggling with behavioral problems, addiction, or mental health issues. Operated by private companies, nonprofits, and faith groups, the programs charge an average of $6,316 a month, sometimes paid by desperate parents, sometimes by state care systems, and advertise their ability to break kids out of destructive cycles through therapy, tough love, and radical changes in environment. About 100,000 teenagers are estimated to go through such programs annually, and reports of abuse abound. Former patients and ex-employees say many providers are more focused on profit than care, and that therapy often consists of verbal and physical abuse, forced labor, food and sleep deprivation, and humiliation. By one estimate, 86 children died in troubled teen programs from 2000 to 2015. Hotel heiress Paris Hilton, who says she was abused at a Utah boarding facility in the late 1990s, is now lobbying Congress to clamp down on the multi-billion-dollar industry. "They stole my childhood," Hilton said, "and they're continuing to steal the childhood of so many other innocent children." What happens inside the facilities? Teens' experiences vary significantly, and many report positive outcomes. But Hilton likens Provo Canyon School, where she was sent at age 17 for rebellious behavior, to a torture camp. During her 11 months there, she says, she was subjected to repeated late-night cervical exams by non-medical staff, made to consume sedatives, assaulted, and forced to shower in front of male guards. Provo Canyon was bought in 2000 by Universal Health Services, one of the nation's largest hospital providers, which says it can't comment on what happened under previous ownership. But news investigations have detailed alleged abuse at other youth UHS facilities. Austin Skidmore, a 19-year-old with autism, suffocated on his vomit after being tackled and restrained by staff at a UHS center in Georgia in 2016. A medical examiner labeled his death a homicide. A year later, a 16-year-old girl at the same facility said her arm was broken when a male employee slammed her to the ground. Her family said it was the sixth time she had been injured at the facility. UHS said patient privacy regulations bar it from commenting on specific cases, but that it works with law enforcement and takes corrective actions when isolated and rare negative events occur. Do the programs work? UHS reports that about 80% of its adolescent inpatients show improvement on clinical outcome measures. But grading such programs is tricky because children enter facilities for a wide array of problems and because there is a lack of independent research. Heather Mooney spent 2 years at a therapeutic boarding school in the late 90s after playing truant and running away from home. She thinks the experience helped her complete high school and succeed in college, but notes that many of her boarding school friends have since died of overdoses and suicide. A former patient named Jackson told the New York Times that he saw both sides of the industry. He said he was held in isolation and sedated at a UHS facility in Utah. UHS said it does not use solitary confinement or drugs as a form of discipline. But at a Texas facility, he said, he received compassionate treatment that helped him address his mental health issues. They're there for the patient, Jackson said. They're there for the child. Are these programs regulated? Not at the federal level, where legislation to reform the industry has repeatedly failed. Congress did launch an investigation into the sector in 2007, but it concluded that the scale of the industry's problems was impossible to gauge because of inconsistent state regulations and a lack of data. There is not even a reliable count of how many facilities are operating nationwide. Outrage over abuses has led some states to crack down on behavioral treatment centers. In 2021, Utah passed a law limiting seclusion and restraint and increasing funding for abuse investigations. California requires residential facilities to operate as nonprofits and has removed foster children sent to out-of-state facilities. Oregon did the same following news reports of a 9-year-old girl sent to a Montana institution run by a national provider, Acadia Healthcare. When Oregon officials visited the girl 6 months later, they found her unwashed and wearing a dirty, too large scrub shirt and paper booties. Acadia subsequently closed the facility because of overall business and operational considerations, not because of alleged mistreatment. Will Congress take action? Hilton's advocacy prompted a bipartisan group of lawmakers to introduce the Stop Institutional Child Abuse Act last year. That bill would authorize a federal study to discover exactly how many kids are being held in residential facilities for behavioral problems and create a working group to develop best practices and prioritize safe and effective outpatient services. But some self-described survivors worry that such legislation would only legitimize the industry, offering a veneer of respectability with little enforcement. It's like trying to put a Band-Aid on an arterial bleed, said Liz Iannelli, who says she was raped by a cook at a therapeutic boarding school in the 1990s, and then bound in a blanket and left in a boiler room for days as punishment for lying about it. This is a devastating, harmful industry. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week. Jonah Goldberg with the Los Angeles Times writes, "A presidential unpopularity contest. No president has ever won re-election with approval ratings as low as Joe Biden's at this point in his first term," said Jonah Goldberg. "But he still might beat Donald Trump. Many political rules of thumb no longer seem to apply, and the 2024 election will essentially be a referendum on two incumbents. Trump left the White House with a 34% approval rating, even lower than Biden's current 40%. And although he is benefiting from some amnesia about the chaos and dysfunction of his 4 years in office, voters will be reminded with a barrage of negative ads. Currently, polls show Trump with a substantial lead over Biden in the swing states, which should worry Democrats and anyone else who doesn't want Trump at the White House. But a recent Quinnipiac University poll found that among voters who dislike both candidates, Biden has a commanding 13-point lead. Polls also show a massive gender gap, with women supporting Biden 58% to 36%. Abortion is likely to play a pivotal role in 2024, as it did in the 2022 midterms. Today, most people vote against the other party more than they vote for their own. And that is Biden's best hope. Will Israel trap itself in Gaza? Despite its no-holds-barred approach in Gaza, said Colin P. Clark, Israel is nowhere close to achieving its goal of eliminating Hamas. Israel says it has killed 9,000 Hamas fighters in its bombardment and ground war, but U.S. intelligence says that more than 20,000 fighters remain hidden in Gaza's rubble and in hundreds of tunnels. 4 months in, the war is morphing into a counterinsurgency campaign like the one the U.S. conducted in Afghanistan and Iraq, which would rely more on special operations forces, precision strikes, and targeted raids. This only plays into the hands of Hamas, which would like nothing more than an opportunity to prolong the fighting. In urban warfare, Hamas fighters can kill Israeli Defense Force soldiers with hidden explosives, explosive devices, snipers, and suicide bombers, while exploiting the propaganda value of mounting Palestinian deaths, which have surpassed 25,000. Past counterinsurgencies like the one Israel is conducting have lasted a decade or more. Making peace with one's enemies is difficult, especially when they've slaughtered 1,200 of your civilians. But under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, it's clear Israel has no coherent political endgame and may be stumbling into a forever war. This column comes from Mexico. How AMLO exploits U.S. border crisis. The U.S. can't control its borders alone. It needs Mexico's cooperation to make a meaningful dent in migration, said Arturo Sarucan. It's our government that determines whether hundreds of thousands of Cubans, Venezuelans, and Nicaraguans may enter Mexico from Guatemala each year, and whether they complete the 1,000-plus-mile journey to Texas or get detained. That gives President Andrés Manuel López Obrador considerable leverage, and he's not afraid to use it. Recently, AMLO's been cynically opening and closing the tap of migrant flows as a way of forcing Washington to do his bidding. Late last year, he abruptly suspended deportation flights of Venezuelans back to Caracas, claiming lack of resources, unilaterally halting a Biden administration policy that had kept thousands of asylum seekers from reaching the border. In December, the government even escorted some migrants through Chihuahua State to the Texas border. Over the next several months, as the U.S. election approaches, AMLO will have the upper hand. He knows what Biden fears most, that Mexico could pull an October surprise, unleashing a torrent of migrants just weeks before the vote, to generate another crisis for Biden and tip the scales for Trump. The last word, our feature article, takes us back to Ukraine for an update on the situation there. Outmanned and outgunned. Battling relentless Russian assaults, Ukrainian forces are running low on ammunition and supplies as U.S. support for Kyiv wavers, said Mark Santora in the New York Times. His unit decimated by Ukrainian fire, the last surviving soldier in a Russian assault, took cover in a shallow crater while Ukrainians shouted at him to surrender. As he lifted two grenades in the air, a Ukrainian drone swept in from above and exploded. Soon the smoke cleared. Surveillance drone overhead showed, revealing the Russian soldier's corpse. That day's attack, just north of the destroyed city of Avdiivka, was repelled. But the Ukrainians were under no illusions. There would be many more. They came in waves, said Lieutenant Alexander Shirskin, 29, the deputy battalion commander in the 47th Mechanized Brigade, and they do not stop. As the war enters its third year, Ukrainians find themselves outmanned and outgunned. After dominating the fighting in the first year and battling mostly to a standstill in the second, they have relinquished the momentum to Russia. Now they are digging in and fighting to hold on. Mortar crews need to ration artillery shells. Troops are being rotated from units in the rear to join undermanned infantry units at the front, and there are shortages of critical supplies needed to repair and maintain Ukraine's armored vehicles. Because the Ukrainians are critically short of ammunition, for instance, they cannot afford to fire at only one or two advancing enemy soldiers. So the Russians have adapted and often move in small numbers to their most forward positions. They try to amass enough soldiers to storm a Ukrainian trench and overwhelm the defenders. Now, we don't have enough equipment, enough people to go on the offensive, Shirshin said, so the main goal for now is to hold the position we have. Ukraine recently announced the allocation of nearly $500 million to build fortifications along its border with Russia and to create a deeper defensive line in the eastern Donbas region that can serve as fallback positions should the Russians achieve a major breakthrough. The epicenter of the fighting remains around Avdiivka in the eastern Donetsk region, where the Russians have staged relentless assaults, no matter the obstacles. They spent weeks fighting for control of an industrial slag heap on the outskirts of the city, sending waves of troops up only to be cut down in horrifying fusillades. They creep through tunnels under the city streets and direct unmanned vehicles packed with explosives at Ukrainian positions. It is all in the pursuit of another annihilated city, but their attacks in Avdiivka and elsewhere along the front serve a larger goal, to seize the advantage at a time U.S. military support to Ukraine has ceased, and to overwhelm the Ukrainians with sheer mass. While they are now almost exclusively engaged in defensive operations, Ukrainian soldiers interviewed along the front said that did not mean they could simply hunker down. They are seeking to inflict maximum pain on Russian forces while avoiding prolonged battles that could result in their own steep loss. For the moment, Russian forces are achieving only marginal gains despite pouring enormous amounts of resources into their winter offensive. Last week, journalists from the New York Times were able to watch several battles with commanders and drone operators around Avdiivka and another ruined city, Vuhledar, two key hotspots on the Eastern Front. The scope of the Russian losses was evident in the fields of ruined armor and the broken bodies of soldiers littering snow-covered fields. The Ukrainians are using mines and other obstacles to channel Russian armor into kill zones, where they can be hit with heavy guns nearly every time they mount an armored assault. They are aggressively using Western-supplied fighting vehicles and tanks as hunter killers when Russian troops get close to the Ukrainian positions. Since the Russians are now able to fire five times as many shells as the Ukrainians in some parts of the front, according to artillery units working on the front, the Ukrainians have had to increasingly turn to bomb-laden drones piloted remotely, known as FPVs, to try to plug the gap. But the Ukrainian firepower is still limited. Major Serhii Betz, 30, the chief of staff of the 48th Separate Rifle Battalion of the 72nd Mechanized Brigade, said that the drones were an effective tool but could not be compared to the big guns. A first-person drone will not disassemble the dugout, will not mow the tree line, he said. It does not exert such psychological pressure on the enemy, and we don't have a lot of FPV crews. The Russians also still dominate the skies, and after a brief pause following the downing of several Russian fighter jets, the aerial bombardments have resumed, soldiers said. Scores of giant craters left by 1,000-pound bombs in annihilated villages testified to the destructive force that Russia continues to bring to bear. While it is unclear how long Ukraine can sustain its defense if its Western allies do not continue to provide robust military support, Ukrainian forces continue to inflict heavy damage on Russian forces while mostly holding the line. Since Russia began renewed offensive operations in October, it has lost 365 main battle tanks and some 700 armored vehicles, but only achieved minor territorial gains, the British Military Intelligence Agency said in January. More than 13,000 Russian soldiers were killed and wounded in only 2 months of operations aimed at capturing Avdiivka, according to a declassified U.S. intelligence assessment released in December. That works out to about 3,000 Russian casualties for every square mile of territorial gains. Still, the British intelligence agency warned that Russia would most likely be able to continue this level of offensive activity for the foreseeable future. If the Russians are interested in a particular section of the front, they will raise it to the ground, said Betz, pointing to a screen showing live drone footage to illustrate his point. Since mid-December, the Russians have completely destroyed this tree line, he said. If you look around the tree line in a radius of 100 by 100, there is just plowed land. But, he said, Ukrainian defenders are digging holes to live somehow, holding on. Still, even small Russian gains pose risks for Ukraine. The capture of Marinka, a town near Avdiivka, outside the city of Donetsk, after years of fighting, has allowed the Russians to open up a new line of attack on Vuhledar from the north. The enemy has partially succeeded, Betz said. We will not hide it. They use their advantage in artillery to disorient our guys in the trenches, and then the infantry comes, he said. We are fighting against the infantry calmly and holding our ground. It is no secret that the Kremlin strategy is to outlast the Ukrainians, and its forces are keenly aware of Ukrainian artillery shortages, soldiers said, repeatedly adjusting tactics to try to gain an advantage. As cannon fire thundered above ground last week in Avdiivka, more than 150 Russians crept through a narrow pipe underground to an important Ukrainian fortified position in a recreational facility called the Tsar's Hut. They emerged behind the Ukrainians and ambushed them, according to both sides. At a campaign event Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin, who is running for re-election, appeared to cite the operation as evidence of success on the battlefield, saying Russian soldiers seized 19 houses and are holding them. As supplies and ammunition dwindle, Ukrainians say, they will have to pay a higher price in blood to simply hold their lines. Lieutenant Serhiy Stretsenko, 40, commander of an assault platoon, said that even if the Russians manage only to claw their way forward a few feet, they dig in and fortify. They will often leave only two or three soldiers at these new forward positions. They call them camels, he said, using a slang term for people who do tedious work while being treated like animals. Those soldiers can spend several days digging while another group assembles before starting another storming operation, he said. Danilo, a sergeant in command of an air reconnaissance unit for the 47th, who asked that his surname not be used for security reasons, said that if the defense is working well, they will break up and attack before it can get fully underway. Defensive operations are much more controlled, Danilo said during an interview at an outpost near Avdiivka. You are setting the conditions for the ground you control. But in battle, things can quickly spiral out of control. Stetsenko described one recent clash when a Russian tank managed to make it to their position. The tank destroys everything in its path, so you won't even stick your head out, he said. They jump out of the vehicles and rush into the trenches, destroying everything in front of them. Guys who surrendered, they shot them all. Betts likened the confrontations to a boxing match. The main thing is the ability to take a punch, he said. I can proudly tell the whole world that Ukraine knows how to take a punch. But this is not the last round. This story was originally published in the New York Times. Here's one of the health and science pieces. The moon is shrinking and quivering. Moonquakes could pose a significant problem for astronauts and eventual lunar colonists, reports USA Today. As its core cools, the moon is gradually shrinking, causing its surface to wrinkle. It's a very slow process. The lunar circumference has decreased only about 150 feet in the last few hundred million years, so it won't affect Earth's tidal cycles. But it does affect the moon, causing faults to give rise to moonquakes. Unfortunately, researchers from the University of Maryland say the problem is particularly pronounced at the lunar South Pole, right where U.S. astronauts are planning to land. Because the South Pole has plentiful ice, it is the touch point for Artemis III, NASA's crewed mission plan for 2026, as well as the most likely site of a lunar colony. The shrinkage, the researchers found, had led to notable warping in that region, causing moonquakes that may last for hours and can result in landslides. Because of the relatively low gravitational pull on the moon, most of these seismic events tend to be small, The most powerful one recorded was about magnitude 5.5. But even a minor shudder on the lunar surface could knock you off your feet. You're not as coupled to the surface on the moon as you are on Earth, says study leader Tom Waters. So even a magnitude 5 quake on the moon would feel much stronger than it would feel on Earth. And we have an article on the Talking Points page referenced in that editor's letter at the beginning. News media, an accelerating decline. In American journalism, is American journalism heading for an extinction-level event? Asked Paul Fari in The Atlantic. With revenues dropping and losses mounting, outlets such as The Washington Post, Time, Vox, Business Insider, NPR, ESPN, NBC, CNN, and ABC have shed hundreds of journalists over the past year. The iconic Sports Illustrated and music website Pitchfork were gutted, and BuzzFeed eliminated its news division. Last week, the once mighty Los Angeles Times laid off more than 20% of its newsroom. There are many factors driving the acceleration of the news media's two decades-long decline, including a massive loss of advertising to the Internet and a glut of free online content. The big recent blow-up is that Facebook and X keep tweaking their algorithms to display fewer news links, causing web traffic and advertising revenue to plummet. At the same time, many Americans are suffering from news fatigue and are just tuning it all out. Another 130 local newspapers closed last year, said Cameron Joseph in the Columbia Journalism Review. Since 2005, two-thirds of U.S. journalism jobs have vanished. That has left more than half of U.S. counties with essentially no local news coverage. The disappearance of reporters covering city halls, state houses, and Congress is corrosive to democracy, enabling corruption and other political mischief to go undetected. Some of my fellow conservatives may gloat over the troubles of the liberal media, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. But most news outlets also do solid, straight reporting that discomforts Democrats. As newspapers, as magazines fold, we're losing one of the last vestiges of a common culture and one of the final arbiters of objective reality. Don't expect beneficent billionaires like Jeff Bezos to save the industry, said Margaret Sullivan in The Guardian. Even the super rich get tired of losing money, which is why wealthy entrepreneur Jimmy Finkelstein abruptly shut the Messenger News website last week after burning through $50 million in a year. Not all news organizations are dying, said Jack Schaefer in Politico. A few prestigious national outlets, like the New York Times and the New Yorker, continue to do fine journalism and make money. Cable, network, and local TV news still toss off profits. But in coming years, most of journalism's survivors, like the animals that persisted after the great comet struck the Earth, will be tiny and eke out an existence in the shadows. And a few of the shorter notes. Donald Trump's political action committees spent about $50 million in donor funds on legal bills in 2023, $29 million of which was spent in the second half of the year. Dartmouth University will once again make applicants take the SAT or ACT exams, citing research that test scores are predictive of first-year college performance at selective colleges and universities. In 2020, all eight Ivy League universities dropped the entry exam requirements. Some 1,900 other institutions that offer bachelor's degree programs are now test optional. Law enforcement seized 1,860 pounds of psilocybin, the main psychoactive ingredient in magic mushrooms in 2022, nearly three times the amount seized in 2017. The psychedelic has boomed in popularity in recent years as a recreational drug and behavioral health treatment. In 2019, terrorism researchers at the University of Maryland identified six violent attacks whose perpetrators said they were motivated by a conspiracy theory. In 2020, the year of the most recent survey, they found 116. On the poll watch, 48% of Americans, including 72% of Democrats, 52% of Independents, and 20% of Republicans say it is essential to get a verdict on Donald Trump's federal charges before the election. Another 16% say they would prefer to see a verdict. 11% say Trump's trial should be postponed until after the election. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from Isaac Newton, quoted in the New York Post, who says, "I can calculate the movement of stars, but not the madness of men." And as I'm sure you can tell from my voice, that is just about it for me today. I hope you have enjoyed it. Thanks for bearing with me, and be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.